Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Drive Through HR, the internet's number one semi-daily talk show. I don't know what to say there anymore. But I am your co-host, Crystal Miller, and I am here with John Sunzer, and we are really excited to have a conversation today about all kinds of things, I'm sure. But before we do that, I have to say we need to do a flash poll. If you are tired of this California love song, please let us know on Twitter, at DriveThroughHR or hashtag DTHR, so we change the music out. If you don't care, we don't care. Let us know. Now, let's introduce today's guest. John, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, Crystal. And so put my vote on the what the hell was that song about in the first place list.
Done. I don't really remember because I've only heard the intro for like the last 2 years. I don't ever go past the intro anymore. So I forgot. I think it's about drugs, but I'm not sure.
So, oh, yeah?
Yeah, probably.
Anyway. Well, I couldn't tell. It sounded like somebody had the bass turned up too high.
That's probably also true. Well, John, I know you, and I've been lucky to know you for several years now, but not everybody knows who you are. So for anyone in the world that doesn't know who John Sunzer is, I feel like you should let people know who you are. Say hi, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm John Sunzer, and I am the founder, editor, chief of HRExaminer.com, which is a these days it's a radio show confederation supplemented with content from our group of about 25 graybeards in HR technology and at the edges of HR. And what I do is look at and think about the edges of HR. And that means that I try to get out ahead of what's going on in the trenches by a couple of years and examine what the emerging issues are going to be and what they look like. And I've been doing this for about 20 years and have a great time. So if you're interested in what the next thing will be, then you want to pay attention to the work that I'm doing at HRExaminer.com.
Wow, that's a heavy statement. If you're interested in this, pay attention to your work, which is cool. I mean, good for you.
Yeah.
But that being said, like the emerging edges of HR. Well, what does that mean? Like, so I mean, well, you gave a little bit of an example, but like, could you give us an example of?
So these days. I'm thinking about and consulting about and practicing a couple of pretty interesting areas. One is that disruption is happening in HR, and the way that we do HR and what we think about inside of HR is being changed largely by the flood of data from all of the various sources that you now can put together to do HR. HR used to be an intuitive discipline, and now it's possible to do it with data. And data means that we have to understand what happens when you measure things. And something that's very interesting, we're moving into an era where lots of aspects of human beings, human behavior, organizational life are starting to get measured, and we don't know what that means. We don't have frameworks for thinking about stuff, so we're kind of jumping around measuring things, and I think we're about to learn a whole lot of lessons about what not to do. And
that's interesting. Why do you think that?
Well, let me tell you a story. This is my Cobra story. In 1850 in Bombay, the streets were flooded with cobra snakes. There were cobras everywhere. It was an infestation like nobody had ever seen before, and it was starting to affect civic life and commerce in the city. So the town council got together to figure out what to do about the cobra infestation. And they decided that what they would do is build a COBRA disposition program. And the gist of the COBRA disposition program was, if you caught a snake and killed it and brought it to the COBRA disposition center, they'd give you $5 or whatever the Indian equivalent of $5 was. And the project was the most successful thing that the town council had ever tried to do. They collected snakes and snakes and snakes. They got more snakes than they thought there had been in the streets. It was astonishing how successful the thing was. So they did what governments do, and they formed a blue ribbon committee to go out into the countryside and see why the program was so successful. What they discovered was that a entire ecosystem of cobra farms had cropped up, and that anybody in town could go to a cobra farm and buy a snake for $2, kill it, and take it to the government and get five. And that's why the thing had been so successful. So there was the normal moral outrage, and people got fired, and all of the things that you expect when something that looks like corruption surfaces happened. And the town council, in their wisdom, decided to kill the program because it was corrupt. And the moment that they killed the program, the value of a snake went from $2 to zero. All of the cobra farms went out of business, and when they went out of business, they released the snakes. So the net result of the program to eradicate snakes was, a year later, that there were 10 times as many snakes in the streets of Bombay. And that's a cobra problem. That's an example of what happens if you are not extremely careful about what you measure and why. So that's the story. Measurement, you know, anybody who took physics in high school knows that measurement always changes the thing that's being measured. That's just physics.
I think that we would see more of a difference in like the cost of acquisition, for example, given the amount of time that we've been measuring the cost of acquisition of talent.
We don't know what we're buying. It's only really been 500 years since men were something other than property, and it's only been about 100 years since women were other than property. And much of our talk about how we engage people in work treats them like objects, right? We acquire talent. Well, holy moly, that was outlawed. There's a 13th Amendment in the American Constitution. It's against the law to buy talent. There's a big nasty word for the buying and selling of human beings, and yet we continue with the metaphor. And so when you treat people like objects to be bought and sold, well, something damaging happens there. You can't do that without there being consequences to it. And so what we measure is a really bad idea when we measure talent acquisition.
Can I give a counterpoint to that? I think some of that's perspective.
Hop right in.
Okay, I think some of that's perspective, right? So people aren't talent. What people do can be considered a talent, right? So me, if you were to look at my body, I'm going to objectify myself here for a minute. There's nothing particularly exciting about me as just a physical person, right? Like I'm an average person. Actually, I'm a little on the fluffy side of an average person. So, you know, just me as a body, not all that valuable. The stuff that I can do, that's what people buy. That's my talent. So I think when we say talent acquisition, I don't know, in the right framework, I don't know that we mean so much the people as what they do. And that's probably an appropriate naming convention at that point, because I am buying the talent that this person has. And you can buy that. I mean, you can buy work, right?
You can certainly buy my services, but that's not the metaphor that we use. We do not use that language, because that implies a contractual relationship amongst equals. And there's nothing about the talent acquisition project that's a transactional relationship amongst equals. The employer always holds the cards in that game, and if you do anything in that process, you're negotiating against yourself. So really, the historical roots of of people doing work is that the boss always owned the people. I love a new serious radio station called Willie's Roadhouse, where they play old 60s and 70s country music. And there was a Johnny Cash song on this morning as I was driving down the road called Oni, which is a story of a guy who's worked in this shop for 29 years and is retiring today. And what he's going to do for his retirement is punch his boss in the nose, because the boss has treated him like a piece of property for the last 29 years. And that's in the same vein as take this job and shove it. There's a lot of country music about people hating their jobs, but going to them and doing a good job every day. And that's what happens when you have the ownership of people as the basic model for how you get work done. Now, we're at a point in time where that's starting to change, but the idea that it's other than an extension of the ownership of people is a little optimistic, I think.
So do you really think that we're at a time where that's starting to change? Do you think just the shift from W-2 employee to contract or project-based work is enough to say that that's shifting? Because at that point...
No. Look at how women are treated in the workplace. They don't get... It's the 21st century, and we're a fairly intelligent universe, and still women are not paid an equal wage for an equal job. Well, that's nonsense. That's more evidence that it's a system that's about purchase and market pricing on commodities rather than on the value of an individual.
So I know, intellectually, I know that's true. There's data to support that. I know that women aren't paid equally. I get it. I struggle with it personally because from an anecdotal perspective, I have not had that problem. I was higher, for the most part, I was paid more than my male counterparts. So, you know, I struggle with some of the stuff that we say, okay, women aren't treated equally, they're not treated fairly, and I think we forget maybe the why. And I think a lot of that why needs to be put back on the different groups that are having issues, because we don't ask, right? Like, so I don't know. I'm going to end up getting flashed.
Yeah. Be real careful here, because the fact that women are not a significant part of the executive team in corporations in the Western world is not the fault of women.
No,
right? And
it's not.
Blaming the victim is a time-honored sport.
Yeah, you're right.
Right, but women didn't do to themselves the fact that they can't get a word in edgewise in the boardroom. That's something that's evolved over a long period of time and can only be corrected by having women in the boardroom. To say that they're not there because they're not there is circular, right?
No. It definitely is, and I shouldn't say that that's the only reason, because it's not, and that's going to sound like I'm backpedaling, and I don't mean to be. But I do think to some extent we need to own that sometimes we don't get paid what we're worth and we don't get opportunities that we should because we don't try for them. And that can be a conditioning of the situation that, you know, the women have not been treated equally. Women have not been afforded the same opportunities. Women have not been trained to deal with them in the same way that men have over the course of centuries, right? But
well, so what I'm seeing that's really interesting is there's a new model emerging. And the new model is not the same old male model. So that's, I think it's really exciting, but we're also making a ton of mistakes, which is sort of the place that I wanted to take this conversation, which is how do you learn from mistakes and how is it okay to go, wow, this really isn't working very well. It's a mistake. Let's see if we can do something better here. And that's a way of learning that I've been lucky enough to be able to make big, messy mistakes over and over and over again as I learned and got better at what I do. I've had the best career you could ever imagine because I've always been able to follow my curiosity. And when I follow my curiosity, there are mistakes to be made. And those mistakes generate vastly more learning than success does. So I think we're on the track with the gender thing to learn the right stuff. It's just painful in the process.
I think most growth is painful, though, right?
Well, I think one of the big fantasies that we sell our children is that learning isn't painful. Learning that matters is precisely a disruption of the way that you see the world, and that means it's disorienting. It means that it's uncomfortable. It may be even more than uncomfortable. It means it produces anxiety, and so what I've been taught over many years is that when I feel like running away because it's scary, that's the time to really dig my heels in because I'm about to learn something. Learning feels scary. And when you make a big mistake, that's really scary. That's a lot of anxiety. And in order to learn, you have to hang in there with it. You have to hang in there with it and not try to fix it right away and try to understand what you're being told.
I like that. So can you
good, okay, well,
go like, that was good. Actually, I want to hear some examples of played out in your life. But before we do that, I need to do a quick reset for anyone joining in. You are joining, listening to Drive Through HR with the one and only Don Sumser. We're very lucky to have him on today. So, John, thank you for giving us some time.
So here's my favorite story. I had when I got out of college, there were no jobs for people like me. Engineers were pumping gas at the point that I got out of college. There was a big recession going on. And one thing led to another, and I got a job as an assistant technical writer in the defense industry, which meant I had to cut my hair and stop acting like a hippie and go to work. And I had a great 15 years in which everything I touched turned to gold. It was wonderful. I made lots of mistakes and learned lots of things and had this tremendous progress where I went from being a liberal arts major to being an engineer and became a software developer and a research and development guy. Fantastic thing. And then I decided to go try to work in a small nonprofit in California. And I really, really blew it. I blew it completely. So the little nonprofit was in Sausalito, California, on the waterfront, and I was so bad at what I did that when they finally fired me, the staff picked up my desk and all this stuff and took it out to the bay and threw it in the bay.
Oh, wow.
They were furious because I came to this small nonprofit of 20 people with all of the impressions and perceptions of somebody who worked in a big company. And so I didn't know some things like in organizational politics, the politics are intense in relationship to the scarcity of resources. So the poorer the organization is, the more vicious the politics are. The smaller the organization is, the more vicious the politics are. And in big organizations where there's lots of resource, politics are pretty tame. I thought it was the other way around. I thought that the bigger something got, the more complicated the politics got. And it turns out that that isn't true. But I didn't know that until after I'd screwed everything up by acting like a guy from a big company who was used to giving orders and having them followed. So the result of being fired from that job was that I was adrift in California with a family to support and no money. And I had to figure out what to do. And that caused me to go into business for myself because I was so ashamed of being fired that I couldn't bear to look for work. So I built businesses as the result of that thing. And it was an extraordinary kick in the butt that sent me into the stuff that made me the happiest I've ever been. Right. So, and that job, by the way, the job that I got fired from was a job I dreamed about having from the time I was 14, and I got it when I was 40. So fired from my dream job was the best thing that ever happened to me. That's what learning from mistakes is about. That's what learning from mistakes is about. And then over the intervening years, I've worked with technology and worked with anticipating the future and helping organizations navigate disruption. And that's, you know, just last summer, I had a project, and the project was to help a big company understand how it might navigate turning from a collection of acquisitions into a software company. And I wrote a paper about the theory of building out a software company and how this particular company didn't map up to that. And the CEO threw me out of his office, fired me, threw me out of his office last year. The interesting thing about that was, after some reflection, I realized that he was right. That he was right, that what I had been doing was telling him about a theory, and what he was doing was running a business. And it had taken me that long to be able to go, oh, right, right. If something's working, that's better than a theory. And even if I don't like the way that it's working, even if it's working in an uncomfortable set of ways, what you do is you go with what's working. And you modify from there, rather than the conventional consultant view of the world, is what you do is you say, oh, it's wrong because it doesn't match up with the theory. Let's tear it all down and start over. And so that was another great learning that was exactly from a massive mistake. And so being able, I think it's very interesting to try to encourage people to talk about making mistakes like you're doing with this series on Drive Through HR, because the learning comes from the mistakes. It doesn't come from success. I'm not sure that success can teach you anything.
I'm going to take a minute, but I agree with that. I mean, I do. We don't need to stop and learn from mistakes. Well, I mean, from success. We should, right? We should always take time to reflect whether we fail or succeed. But success is really nebulous, too. Like, how do you know when you've achieved it? When do you stop?
I think that the human thing to do is to congratulate yourself and miss that that success actually breeds arrogance and vanity, and that the greatest mistakes tend to come from arrogance and vanity. Like my mistake with the consulting thing, thinking that I knew better than the guy whose business it was and that my theory was somehow better than the guy whose business it was. That's a pretty silly position to take in hindsight, but I was on a roll. And I'd been pretty fortunate in my assessments of things, I just overstepped my bounds, and that can be the sort of the snowball that starts the avalanche. I guess is that hubris comes from success. Hubris is the child of success, and hubris causes us as human beings to do things that are, maybe the judgment isn't quite as sound when you think you know everything. So that.
Okay.
So, on to the next series of mistakes, right? Because what we're about to do with measurement, just to bring this all the way around, is we're about to make some pretty serious mistakes. And those serious mistakes look like we are starting to have systems that allow you to manipulate the culture of the organization that you're in. And we're starting to have lots of different ways of manipulating the culture of the organization that you're in. And those ways tend to look like you measure it and then you change things to get the measurement right. And the difficulty is we don't really have a good theory of what organizations are, and much of what we're measuring is transactional. So we have a ton of data about the decisions that people make inside of workflows and the results that they get inside of those workflows. But if you take all of those transactions, all of those decisions, and you add them all up and you put them in a bucket, you actually only account for about 60% of what an organization does. The rest of it we call culture, because we don't have a better word for it, and I'm not sure that that's the right thing to call it. But right now we're calling it culture. And it turns out that what culture is the thing that speeds up and slows down all of those transactions. So if you want to see what's going on inside of a company and you measure all of the transactions, the thing that you're missing is a sense of what makes those transactions go better and worse, and even more importantly, an idea of what the good is. What is a good result? Is a good result faster and better decisions, or is a good result slower decisions with more mistakes? I don't think we have a clear picture of that. The business people want anything that gets in the way of a return on the dollar of investment to be the primary factor, but that gets at the beginning of our conversation, which is that's when you buy talent. If your sole concern is that the invested dollar produce a precise return, then you don't have time to actually invest in human beings because they're sloppier. They don't produce precise returns. Machines produce precise returns. And so we're veering into a world where there are going to be some major experiments about what happens when you treat people like machines, although the people doing those experiments don't know that that's what they're doing right now. All of this stuff gets very dangerously close to human experimentation, and that's the thing to be concerned about, because we are manipulating the emotions and the pressure and the stress that human beings experience at work with data. And, you know, the Geneva Convention sort of discourages using people as the objects of an experiment.
I think one could argue that life is one giant experiment, but so I mean, there's that, right? But backing up a little bit here, so I think we've been treating people like machines for far longer than what we maybe care to admit. It's a new thing. I mean, we've replaced a lot of jobs with machines, right? But like, you can go back to picking corn and cotton and other, you know, crops. People used to do that. They were totally judged by the number of units they were able to put out per hour, and there was an expectation that you should be able to hit that. Shoot, my first job in a grocery store, I was fired, by the way. First and only job I was ever fired from. But I was straight up fired because you were supposed to do 21 units per minute, right? 18 puts you on probation. And I couldn't get it because I talked too much. Shock. So, you know, that's all very numbers oriented, and they tracked all of that. And shoot, that was longer ago than I care to admit, over 20 years ago. So is this really a new thing?
Oh, it's just the tools that we have to do it with that's new. Right? The degree to which we can measure behavior and make claims about what good behavior is and isn't is, I think, significantly expanded. And okay. And our ability to see that is significantly expanded. So the application, we don't know what happens when you deliver data as feedback. What happens to human beings when you give them hard, quantifiable feedback on a regular basis? I don't think we know.
Well, I think in some jobs we've had that for a really long time. right? So when you look at, again, look at like retail, like you knew how many units people were pushing for decades. That's not new. You knew what their sales per hour was, their sales by minute, their sales by department. And that feedback would be translated weekly when sales reports were run. So how did they behave? How did that impact them?
Well, you know, anybody who had one of those jobs who liked it?
Well, okay, there's that.
Well, when people don't like stuff, we're back to blaming the victim. When people don't like stuff, that's really important information. I don't like it that you're doing that to me. All of the talk about the enfranchisement of women and the ability to say no is what I'm talking about, and that applies to all human beings, that there is a place where I don't like that means, no, this isn't good and this isn't healthy and we shouldn't be doing it. And I don't think we've looked at that hard enough yet.
Okay, that might be true, but that also brings up a really interesting question of what are you buying when you hire someone?
Exactly.
Like, so
exactly.
Like, yeah, that's what we've been talking about. Welcome to the conversation. But really, what are you buying? At what point does expectation become too much? And does accountability, and accountability is not enough? Like, I have to wonder, like, there's a balance to all of this, obviously. But to some extent, no, employees probably don't like being held accountable to their work within reason, right? There's a point where it goes over, and you expect too much out of someone. Sorry, I'm just trying to think through this. But what are we buying, and how much are we allowed to expect out of what we're buying?
Well, and are you buying, or are you renting, or are you? I don't even know that we know what you're doing. I guess is the way that I'd try to say that. I don't know at all that we know what's going on when you get involved with somebody as an employee. And I believe that in the United States, for example, there are maybe a dozen core cultures, and each one of those cultures would have a different answer to the question, what are you buying when you buy help? From the Jeffersonian sort of view, where help is the obligation of the worker, to the New York point of view, where it's a pure transaction and you're buying exactly what you're paying for at the moment that you pay for it. And there's a ton of other frames for the social contract. And until you have a sense of what that frame is, it's really hard to tell what you're buying. Right, so what you're buying is a cultural artifact of the organization that's doing the purchasing, I think.
Hmm. That's very profound. And obviously
sure.
It's
a much longer conversation. I'd love to have that with you sometime.
I would love that too, and we still have to whiteboard. But for other people that would like to have this conversation with you, because I'm fairly positive that I'm not the only one that's in this conversation going, but I need like another couple of hours to just start to wrap my brain around this and talk through it with you. And where can this go? And if they want to continue this conversation, what's a good way for them to get a hold of you?
The best bet is to look for me on Twitter. I'm at John Subzer on Twitter and have been known to respond to Twitter, but not perfectly. You can also send me a piece of email at john@hrexaminer.com. And I'm delighted to hear from people. Absolutely delighted to hear from people.
Well, John, once again, you have bent my brain a bit, which I like, right? So I've got to go back and kind of assimilate some of what we talked about and figure out like what questions I want to ask you, but I know there will be some. So I'd love to have you back on the show again to talk about this or anything else that you'd like, because I've never had a boring conversation with you.
Well, that would be fantastic, and I'd love to do it. This the Drive Through HR series is an extraordinary experiment in defining the landscape of HR, and I'd love to be a part of it.
Well, then it's a date. We'll have to do it. All right. On that note, I know you've got stuff to do today, and unfortunately, I think our listeners do too. So we'll wrap up. But any parting thoughts that you want to leave with the audience?
Yeah, I would say that the more mistakes you can make, the better off you are, and that the universe rewards mistake making.
That's also a little profound. The universe rewards mistake making. Gosh, wouldn't it be great though if you felt like that while we were making the mistakes?
Yeah, well, the way you can tell it's a mistake is it doesn't feel like that.
There you go.
Okay. Well, so thanks, Crystal.
It's been great. All right. You have a fantastic day.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.